And wasn't she also responsible for a sort of personal vendetta against the LSSP unions in the port while he was minister?
That is because the LSSP went all out against him personally for joining Bandarnagar in 1956. So it acted two ways. Actually, just imagine the situation. If the LSSP and the Communist Party had given Philip the loyalty and support they are giving Mrs. Bandarnayake now, if they had given it in 1956, coming to a coalition government towards the tail end of the 56 government, Bandarnayake may still have been alive, because the left would not have been divided amongst itself, and the whole history of Ceylon politics may have been different. Useless, of course, speculating. This is an academic problem now, but they are offering Mrs. Bandarnayake almost on the same terms, almost on the same economic program and political program of Bandarnayake, a degree of cooperation they were not willing to extend to Philip, who was considered left of Bandarnayake in 1956.
Uh-huh. In fact, why wasn't there a no contest pact in 60 March?
Between?
Between the SLSP and the...
Because of the intransigence of the LSSP. The LSSP sincerely felt wrongly that they could win the elections and NM would be Prime Minister. It was held on March the 19th. And they are. Can you remember the slogans they put up on the walls in the English language? 19th March. So N for 19th, M for March. In glaring headlines, NM, spelling out 19th March, as if on the 19th of March he was to be Prime Minister. So they took a gamble. And it didn't pay off. You see, it was reduced to shambles. Mm-hmm. From a political force in this country, they emerged as a farce.
And so did Philip's party.
Correct. Mm-hmm. Philip took that gamble because of NM. Instead of which, if even at that time, Philip took that gamble because also of the bitterness of being thrown out of the SLSP. If Philip had political maturity, he was asked to come to terms on a no-contest agreement with Mrs. Bandarnayake. That second round. And he refused. Even at that stage, if he had been humble enough, personally, you know, this shows the personal factor over and above a purely Marxist interpretation of political currents. Mm-hmm. We take the textbook and read it out and try to find the solution without taking into consideration also the human factor.
Now, if it's not too leading, why did you leave the CP and join the SLSP?
For two reasons. Mm-hmm. One is, two main groups of reasons. One is that Hungary shocked me. The events in Hungary. I believe I was in Europe at that time.
And
I was in Hungary shortly before. I knew a large number of Hungarian student friends. And I met some of them come over. So I was terribly shocked at what happened in Hungary at that time. But I cannot say that I left the party purely because of Hungary. Because nevertheless, I convinced myself, even though I may have been wrong, that Hungary was necessary and that certain decisions, however distasteful, must be taken, and that what Engels said was correct, that socialism is scientific and not utopian. But after I came back to Ceylon and the Communist Party accepted Mrs. Bandarnayake's leadership and the SLSP as the main political force, then it seemed illogical for me to remain outside the SLSP when I could make a much greater contribution, coming as I do from a rural area, accepting the perspectives of the rural population in these areas. It seemed illogical for me to alienate myself from the mainstream of the anti-UNP struggle. And the mainstream of the anti-UNP struggle now is the SLSP. Mm-hmm. But like all social democratic parties, it has a right wing and has a left wing. In remaining within the SLFP left wing, I do not jettison my socialist beliefs and faith, but I accept also that I have certainly dropped one or two principles which were fundamental to Marxism. I do believe that you cannot achieve socialism through a revolutionary process in Ceylon. I accept that now. I also accept that religion is important in the present state of human intellectual development, not only for the masses of the people, but eventually for individuals like myself. Mm-hmm. By that I don't mean practicing religion, but the consolation of religion, the spiritual content of religion. I wouldn't use that word cruelly, as opium might be to laugh at a sensitizing.
An insurance?
the, in old age.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because I do believe that materialism alone now is not enough. But I would not try to impose this point of view by organized religion. I am opposed to churchism, templeism, Kovilism, mosquism, if you get what I mean, you know. I am for this personal type of religion. It's incidental as to what you believe in thereafter. You might find that through a God, I might find it through a philosophy. But quite definitely, I accept now that religion must play a part in human life at our present level of cultural development, present intellectual level. We are not emancipated from fear which necessitates religion.
And what is your attitude to the split in the Communist Party?
Well, I believe that that is a very great tragedy, but that is a cliche. But there is this hope that in India, the Peking wing and the Moscow wing joined together in Kerala and has taught us in Ceylon that if these two wings join together, they become a much more powerful force. So if the perspectives of both these wings could be primarily national and secondarily international, then it will be much easier to come together.
Mm-hmm.
Thereafter, each of the two parties are entitled to have their opinion about Khrushchev on the one side or Mao Tse-tung on the other.
Mm-hmm.
But basically, on national problems, they should be able to talk together on the same platform. And I don't see why Peter Kenneman should be worried that Shanmugadasan attacks the Soviet Union, or Shanmugadasan should be worried that Peter Kenneman chooses to attack the Chinese Communist Party or China. Because on national problems, and if it will be a, it would be a great contribution to the progressive movement in this country if both those national leaders kept their mouth shut about the Soviet Union and China for some time and concentrated on national politics.
Either on personal or ideological grounds, which side are you closer to?
Well, frankly, theoretically, I believe that the Chinese party is right.
Mm-hmm.
But I do not know that in practical terms, that that is the best tactic to adopt at this stage. Because, for instance, it expressed itself, this line expressed itself in the attack on India, military attack on India. In attacking India, they did not help the Chinese Communist Party. They did not help the Indian Communist Party. They did not help the Southeast Asian Communist Parties. They have not helped the World Communist Movement. So it is illogical for the Communist Party to take a decision that boomerang so totally on them, destroying their organization. From that point of view, it is obvious that they are, that this ideological dispute is ill-timed and is causing damage to the international communist movement. But generally, that there should be militancy in the working class movement, that you cannot ally yourself with capitalism to achieve socialism. Those are too obviously true to need argument, you see. It's a matter of tactics thereafter.
And what about the economic policies of the two Bandaranaike governments?
Bandaranaike himself was much more closer to accepting that capitalism with mild alterations could lead eventually to socialism. I think Mithi Bandaranaike has taken more fundamental steps towards a socialist economy than Bandaranaike did. Ilangaratne being a very good example of to what extent the SLFP went under Mithi Bandaranaike.
Mm-hmm. But
and Stanley Soyza, being the finance minister under Bandaranaike, is self-explanatory because he is so Catholic in his beliefs,
mm-hmm.
so socially reactionary in his attitude, then economically very little different from the UNC. He almost tried to make out, you see, that despite his being in the SLFP, his attitudes were still UNP and he was correct in class and attitudes, you see.
I know that.
I'm talking about Stanley Soyza.
What about the economic the low state of our economy now, which is not of course solely due to the Bandaranaike government, but which I think has been contributed to it by one or two of its policies, and it's more its administration, I think.
Also, the economy of Ceylon is bad,
mm-hmm.
admittedly not so bad as India,
mm-hmm.
and perhaps not so bad as Indonesia. Nevertheless, I believe that with the high level of literacy in this country,
mm-hmm.
an organized campaign by the radio and the newspapers,
mm-hmm.
we could educate our people.
And films.
And films, accept that they have to tighten their belts,
mm-hmm.
in this context, whether the religious leaders like it or not. The techniques of birth control must be made available to the humblest folk.
In fact, what is the position of the Buddhist orders on this?
Well, I don't think the Buddhist order, I think the Buddhist orders do not have any opinion on it, like the Roman Catholic Church does. But surely, conservative opinion looks a little aside at discussing birth control, because they think they are discussing sex. Mm-hmm. They don't realize that you are discussing mathematics, that we have the highest birth rate next to Japan, and that therefore we have every year 300,000 mouths more to feed, and in 10 years we have 3 million people, and that productivity doesn't rise up to those levels. They think that when you discuss birth control, there is kind of slightly irregular. But nevertheless, it's a question that has to be faced, because there's an optimum population level which this country can accommodate. Anu Jayawardene is of the opinion that an industry can be run if you have 20 million people. But then where do you find the food to feed those 20 million people in Ceylon, considering rainfall and the availability of land? So maybe that we have to educate our people to come back to 7 to 8 million as a safe margin. Mm-hmm. I would not know. That you must ask kind of, not a family planner, what do you call those people? The demographers, is that right? I met a chap called Chandrasekhar, who had an education in America, who was in India, in Delhi. He'd married an American girl, I think, who was equally competent intellectually. And I was attended a Marxist study group in Delhi. And he came out with the theory of that Malthus was more right than wrong, whereas the Communist Party colleagues were attacking him. I had no fixed attitude except to accept the Marxist line. But after listening to Chandrasekhar, I found nobody there who could answer him properly. And nor was that question answered adequately in the Soviet Union of these things when I talked to communist demographers. They use cliches to say that it is a capitalist way of thinking, and you know, not solving the facing the economic problem, not solving it through socialism, seeking slick shortcuts. But the richer families in the Soviet Union and in China, there were smaller families. So the 8 children to 10 children, and the heroines in the Soviet Union for producing many children, they were farmers. So that means that the kind of intellectual aristocracy of both communist countries accepted in a personal sense the necessity for birth control. It was illogical thereafter to unite to the peasantry and make those same techniques, education available. And I'm sure the rural areas will respond, because apparently India, a province, a village near Bombay, Ramda or Ramgad or something, has responded very well according to, can you remember that New Statesman correspondent, Tanya Zinkin, I think was
Tanya
her name. Tanya Zinkin. That lady used to write articles on this, and reading them, I gathered that it was successful. Mm-hmm. And we are developing a way now from pure contraceptives to oral pills, mm-hmm. which are
At this point, the original spool was reversed. The interview is continued.
It's an inspiration to fight an election campaign with Mrs. Bandaranaike. 15 days after the campaign starts, by that I mean a period of time when she gets warmed up. She's a leader in every sense of the term, that way. Fearless, she knows her perspective, she knows what she's fighting for. You see, that way she's a real inspiration.
And does she go to the heart of the problem in her speech?
Undoubtedly. Very courageous.
So,
why do you want to force her to wear something to please you? Galant. May I attend? For calling an editor.
The interview was interrupted at this point, but is continued.
The point you made about the English-educated intellectuals and the England
returned. England returned,
Yeah, the England returned, who couldn't, at least many of whom couldn't translate their politics in a way which would capture the masses. Is that correct?
Yes. Well, you see, I believe that from my experience and observation, that 95% of the leaders that came back from London in the 1930s, right up to say about 1945, and were affected by the socialist ideas either of Lasky, Spanish Civil War, or the Communist Party, international members that joined the International Brigade and died in Spain, you see. Now all those groups, when they left Ceylon, came from families who had no roots in the rural area. I believe that for at least 3 generations, if you take each one person individually and study the family background, for each one of them for about 3 generations had lived in Colombo, isolated themselves from their rural relatives, And with the solitary exception perhaps of Philip Gunawardena, who had rural connections and who was nurtured in a semi-feudal rural area and atmosphere, his home. Except for him, all others had, before they left Ceylon, already alienated themselves from the mainstream of Sinhala Buddhist culture, and had, I believe, the English public school educated Ceylonese contempt towards the poor relation and his culture that should be talked to through the kitchen. So that already when they went to England, they had isolated themselves from the nationalist movement, as you would have understood it in India.
Mm-hmm.
Then they came back after solidifying those prejudices in the climate of an English university. And when they came back, instead of individually, as in the Indian National Congress, Nehru and the English return of his environment did, going back to Wardha and drawing inspiration from the fabric of a Hindu culture and intertwining it with the requirements of the political struggle of the Indian nationalist movement, here they didn't even go back to the rural area. They went straight to what they thought was a proletariat in Colombo Harbour and tried to get them into unions and had contact always with English-speaking intellectuals from the YMCA. So as a result, a movement which could have flowered into a national movement became confined entirely to English-educated intellectuals with their perspectives and prejudices oriented towards England, drawing inspiration from Europe and always looking upon the nationalist movement as a kind of backward, primitive and confined to the kitchen and the poor relation.
With regard to Bandar Nayak, this analysis would apply to his father, despite his father's rural roots, but it wouldn't apply to the son, perhaps because the son reacted against his father.
I think that's correct. You know, the father had the same lurking affection and respect for European social culture, for European imperial culture,
mm-hmm.
for European culture in the colonies, much as the LSSP leadership had. And I believe that the wearing of dinner suit by certain LSSP leaders indicates how totally alienated they were. I mean, it's like expecting Nehru to have led the Indian nationalist movement in top hat, or Rabindranath Tagore to have led the Bengali cultural renaissance in European attire. So Bandar Nayak was sufficiently wise to realize at that time when he came back, and he had this advantage even though born on the wrong side of the blanket.
Mm.
You see, he nevertheless lived in a rural area. And although the limited acreage of Horogolla was confined to a European social culture, whenever he left the house, whenever he went around Veyanguda, 99% of the people lived in rural mud huts. So when he wanted to be their member, he had necessarily to go to a rural area. The tragedy of one of the LSSP leaders is, though he represented a rural area, though he broke the back of feudalism, that is Yatiyankota, which was Ruangwell originally,
mm-hmm.
nevertheless, he lived his entire life in Colombo without becoming a leader. The one other person was a communist leader from the south, who could well have been a national leader. But he was not totally accepted by the people in the context of the nationalist movement because his wife was European.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, he could well have been. So it's one of those tragedies. On the other hand, I'll give you one example,
mm-hmm.
rather two. Mohan Kumar Mangalam of Madras, who went to E2, Cambridge, and who was the president of the Cambridge Union, came back to Madras and became a very close friend of Gandhiji and associated himself with the nationalist movement through Wardha and was the secretary of the Communist Party in one of the Madras units. He is now the Advocate General of India. But that's an example of a person totally educated in England and at Eton, of all places. There is also Nambudripad, who will be the Prime Minister of Kerala and who was once before, who came into the Communist Party through Wardha and association with Gandhiji. We have not one single leader of the left movement who came into the struggle, anti-imperial struggle in Ceylon through the Buddhist movement. Not one. And that is the tragedy, because even Dr. Vikramasinghe was for some time, I believe, the secretary of the Mahabodhi Society or the BTS. So he could well have been. But accepting textbook Marxism and not equating it to the specific requirements of syllabus, it was a study in sublime failure.
What about the Communist Party itself? Don't you think that sometimes its international connections and its affiliation has hindered it locally?
Yes, less so than the LSSP, because the Communist Party has in its central committee about 80% working class. As a result of which, in their political decisions, the mind of the worker peasant in this country is brought to bear, unaffected by the literature of the West and by social cause.
Of more worker than peasant.
Well, more worker than peasant, but those workers have peasant relations. So they have the prejudices of the uninformed and untutored about international affairs. Disadvantage it has because they are after, because its perspectives are national. To that extent, it has captured the entirety almost of the teachers' union. The Singhala Teachers Union is much more communist-oriented than it is LSSP. LSSP, Central Committee, 90% almost is packed with English-educated, middle-class returns from England, who still have a sneaking affection and respect, you know, and as if to create something of an England, of not merely an England of the working class and of industries, but England of the junior common rooms of universities. That is the tragedy.
Or the library of the British Museum.
Yes, you know, this kind of small talk at corner houses.
And don't you think that throughout, especially the LSSP, has suffered from sort of dichotomy. They are working within the parliamentary system, but yet not quite revolutionary in their method.
Now they'll flower because they have rejected completely the revolution. I think we must accept that. That they would not like to admit it. They will go on talking of basic principles and a return to Trotskyism, but they abandoned Trotskyism completely and totally, without hope of return, when they accepted the social democratic perspective of the SLSP. I don't believe that you would do right by yourself to continue accepting the LSSP as a Marxist party. I'm not making a prophetic prediction. I will not be surprised if the LSSP, within the years to come, applies for membership in the SLSP.
Going back to the 50s and the UNP rule, wasn't the decision to go to have an election in 56 a capital political blunder on Sir John?
Yeah, the tragedy is that I am told by Nadesan, who was his private secretary, senior civil servant, that astrologically his return was on the cards. You see, that is one. Two, they could not anyway have afforded to wait till next year after, because there was on paper in Parliament the motion for making Sinhala the national language. If that was discussed and passed, Kotalawal would have been caught with the complete lack of Tamil support and the Sinhalese of his own party moving towards Bandaragada.
Oh, so it was on a political calculation?
I think a mistaken political calculation. I cannot believe that he would have taken a risk for no reason.
And also, isn't it correct to say that, I mean, people grew so anti-UNP because they were so out of touch, spending money freely, flashing about.
And they are symbols of European, alien from the rural areas. They are clothes, they are speech, they are modes of transport, and even the technical level at which they live had nothing in common with the rural areas. They are even Buddhist UNP families celebrated Christmas rather than Vesak. They identified themselves much more with the social life of Colombo and the dance circles in international clubs in Colombo. Queen's House was a symbol of that high living and international life. Race horses, you see, gambling, European social culture, and jitterbugging. Utterly alien to the Sinhala Buddhist renaissance that was developing in the country around, and Buddha Jayanti was the year in which this election was to be held. They held it the year before that year, you see. Naturally, the minds of the people were educated by this vast distinction between the two groups.
Mm-hmm. And taking both UNP and SLSP rule in the 50s, don't you think that they undermine the efficiency of the civil service by undue interference?
Well, don't you think that the civil service also did not come up to expectations by accepting the policies of the SLSP? You see, this was very much like that English theory that the bureaucratic apparatus rules whatever the political party in power. Mm-hmm. You know, that the English civil service is really the ruling force in Britain. Now, I do not know of many civil servants who intellectually and honestly accepted that they were called upon in 1956 to reorient their attitude to new perspectives. So that a large number of civil servants can be accused of having deliberately twisted Bandar Naik's policies and wanted a return to the UN. Mm-hmm. So if anybody is to be blamed for forcing the civil service to adopt political attitudes individually, then surely the civil service is to blame first for not playing its the role that was expected of it, of interpreting the new policies of the government, you see.
I was thinking of a lower level, you know, at the MPs constantly meddling in this and that, and that had a bearing on 1958.
You mean the MPs interfering with the Kachari?
Yes.
I believe they did not interfere with the civil servants as such on minor matters. Mm-hmm. You see, they did not interfere in the transference of a clerk. They didn't go to the GA with little minor requests like that. But they may have interfered in a very big way with the appointments to minor grades. And minor clerks pass through a lot of irregularities. But then, that is not the fault of the SLFP alone. Mm-hmm. It is the fault which the UNP
began
by making the civil service kind of UNP agents in the villages. Mm-hmm. You will pour out the tea.
Okay.
I don't know whether there are any biscuits. There may be some ginger nuts. No, no, I did not. Visakha, he's pouring out your tea as well, eh?
Oh.
No, good, good. Go ahead.
When you were in England and heard, got the news about the communal rights, did it surprise you?
Well, I can't say that I was surprised because I didn't hear of its intensity. I heard there were riots, and when you use the word riots and you've lived long in England, it doesn't occur to you that it could be so brutal and primitive as it had been in Ceylon. You know, it makes anybody ashamed to feel that human beings act like that when you really come across it. When I came back, you see, I mean, it was a shattering experience, you see.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't realize the horror, the extent of the brutality, you see. But when I came back, lots of friends, Tamil friends, told me what they had been through personally, you see.
Now, and don't you think that's one blot on Bandar Naik's government?
Again, Chelvanayagam could have handled it much more tactfully by realizing that his attitudes in the north, you see, didn't take into consideration the fact that there were hostages, pockets of Tamils throughout the Singhalese area. That this is identical to the communalism let loose by Jinnah in India, for which it would be wrong to blame Nehru. You see, if Jinnah had tempered his demands consistent with the situation in India at that time, that communal rioting need never have taken place. His very intransigence created a reflex intransigence in those groups which he antagonized and alienated. Because I don't think any Singhalese person whom I have met is hostile to the demands of the Tamils for the preservation of their culture and its development in traditional Tamil areas. That would be the northern province. But to ask that the eastern province also be regarded as purely Tamil is for the Singhalese community to stand by and offer the Muslims to the Tamils as a sacrifice for their support. Look at it like that. What is the homeland you are offering the Muslims then? Batticalo might well be a Muslim homeland, why should it necessarily be a Tamil? And why, what if the Muslims choose to learn Sinhala and want to do it in exchange for an Islamic university in Batticalo where Islamic culture is preserved and guaranteed? So those factors could have been the basis for negotiation, instead of which in a fascist-like way, Chelvanayagam asking that he be regarded as the sole representative of his people and making demands which no government could have agreed to at that time. I believe that the leadership of the Tamil Congress was responsible in a large measure for what befell that community. Kalpanada Chief Kerala, what
have
you done?
I have to give her milk.
Then why did you serve it here and bring her?
ඉතින් මේක බීලා ඉවරයි.
නෝ
මම අර බීලා අර කිරි බීදර බීලා එන්ට අමගින් ඉඳලා. මොකක්ද පාකේ? මොකද ඕනේන්නේ? අම්මට පොරි. මොනවද ඕනේන්නේ දුවට? එන්න මේක බීලා ඉලා අපි දැන් අත්තක ඉදර බීලා ඉක්මනට. ඉක්මන නැසන්නේ. නැසන්නේ. නැසම් අපි කියන්නේ.
suffering. The final aspect, 65 to 66, the LSSP, Mrs. Bandaranaike Union. What reasons would you give for their failure?
Let me start by telling you that I agree that such an alliance was necessary. Mm-hmm. I am sorry that it was confined only to the LSSP. It would have been much better if the MEP was also brought in. Mm-hmm. You understand? And then surely the Communist Party would have extended support to that alliance. So that numerically speaking, Mrs. Bandaranaike could not have fought the UNP in the face of a united left front also attacking her on the other side. So tactically and as a politically correct decision, a political decision, it was correct to ally herself with the left forces. Now thereafter my criticism is that the LSSP and the LSSP leadership alone are responsible for what has resulted. Now because this is an academic discussion and you will accept that one does not on a political platform criticize your own rank, but with on an academic level one is entitled to have this type of discussion because it is not disloyalty to a political organization or a political movement. And unless you have self-criticism and analysis, you can't develop the movement. So I am not being critical in the presence of everybody, if you get what I mean. Mm-hmm. I cannot as a politician express these attitudes on a public platform because that is weakening ourselves in a struggle against the UNP. But unless we really purify ourselves and focus attention on what really were the mistakes committed by the leadership, then we will not be able to prepare for the future. And we must accept that at that time, the Toddy Bill alienated the Buddhist priests and the Press Bill alienated the middle class intelligentsia in the country. Mm-hmm. And what the leftists have been accused of all along is that they were against personal freedom and against religion. Mm-hmm. And on those two points, we were trapped at the most, at a very decisive stage in our struggle. By our erroneous political planning, by our erroneous decisions, we were trapped. I don't think we have recovered completely yet from that. Mm-hmm. But I do believe that the LSSP is arriving at a conclusion that they did make a mistake, that it was not well timed, the press bill was not, nor was the Toddy Bill. Mm-hmm. And if on these two issues we can convince the Buddhist clergy that we are not anti-Buddhist, then I believe that gradually they are coming over to us because they are awakening to the fact that the UNP is certainly not likely to protect Buddhism vis-a-vis Catholic. That at the best, the status quo will be maintained, and that means that Buddhism will be a second-class religion in Ceylon. That the best schools, that the best jobs, why take the Navy, the Army, the Air Force and the police today? Mm-hmm. The heads of all those, with the exception of the Air Force, are non-Buddhists. Take the Supreme Court and the number of non-Buddhists.
Now you can give a
But surely it's a factual mistake to say that the Catholics are on top as a religion. I mean, there's no chance that the Buddhist religion will be suppressed, is there?
No, except that once economically you have the best jobs available for the Catholics, and the best jobs in all fields, not only government appointments and as I told you in the armed forces, but in commercial agency houses as well and on estates, then you give the impression to the Buddhists, especially those who are seeking jobs in a place where there is a shortage of jobs. Mm-hmm. So you give the fellows the impression that, you know, it's much better for you to be a little negative about Buddhism, not so enthusiastic about Buddhism, then it's likely that you'll be considered by Catholic groups for those extra jobs to keep you Catholic. We might well finish up like South Vietnam. I would not put that because I can't see. If, for instance, the situation in India develops and the Communist Party in Kerala makes headway, then surely America will be worried about its repercussions in this country as well. And then the only loyal section that America can turn to would be the Catholic groups in this country. And if that does happen, then we are in for what has happened in Vietnam.
Mm-hmm. And you think they should have dropped the Toddy Bill as soon as they sent
stuff? Practically, the Toddy Bill was a wonderful idea in that it would have given us pure toddy, it would have stopped illicit tapping, and it would have probably had a purer Ceylon brew in a couple of years' time. There are tremendous advantages, but it was not the correct time. And the moment they realized that Buddhist opinion was hardening on this position, the moment the LSSP leadership saw that happening. Tactically, they should have accepted it and dropped it altogether. What harm? And what was the difficulty in doing and achieving this objective by asking the excise inspectors in rural areas not to prosecute a person seen climbing a coconut tree for toddy? That's all they had to do. Then the villagers would have known that they were allowed to tap a toddy from coconut trees and that the police would not interfere.
But,
see how brilliantly they are handling the situation in Poland, the Communist Party vis-à-vis the Catholic Church. How China is handling it vis-à-vis the Muslim population, which is about 40 million. How cleverly they are handling that situation.
It's strange that Buddhist opinion should have accepted this propaganda against the text, because really, I mean, look at it.
Because we are a nation of toddy drinkers.
Yes,
and that they should know. Well,
in effect, they're supporting Kasipu.
Correct. No, I don't think the second part they thought about, the villagers, that they are supporting Kasipu. Mm. But I think the greatest support against the SNFP government came from women who saw their husbands as potential drunkards as a result of this bill. The anti-progressive forces had so effectively carried out propaganda that was the impression in the minds of the rural women, that, you know, this is merely a bill to make their husbands drunks.
And what about the anti-press control? Did the president really take this to
heart? I don't think he gave a damn about the press bill, because he didn't mean, I don't think he understood what it meant in the first instance, and it only had an effect on the intelligentsia.
Mm-hmm.
But it was so tactless, because all they had to do was to allocate 5 million rupees. You see, allocate means call for public subscriptions of about 5 million rupees and start a press, and then give all the important news hot to that press.
You want another cup of tea?
No. Right, it's just.
With regard to the future, don't you think there is one danger in the fascist tendencies of the SLFP?
Do you mean by that only racial? You're obviously confining your question to one aspect of fascism, which is racial fascism, not the economic aspect.
No, not the economic.
No, it's purely racial.
Yeah.
So what you really want to know is, where will this cry of Sinhala Buddhism end?
Yes, that's right.
I think that is the... Don't you think that, you know, Buddhism by its very tolerance will prevent the development of a rigid fascist ideology? I think. Because nowhere in the world are those two terms compatible. There is nothing called a Buddhist dictatorship, because Buddhism is tolerant. Not a question of what I feel as a Buddhist, you know. The doctrine prevents the establishment, it prevents killing in its name. So from that point of view, any effort to establish a Buddhist dictatorship will result in failure.
Mm-hmm.
At its height, this will unify the Buddhists to ask for their rights on the economic scale.
Yeah.
I do not think thereafter that it will ask for the domination or the extermination of other racial groups. And never forget that once the economic problem is in fact solved, or there are definite signs of it being solved, nothing is closer to Buddhism than Hinduism. Nothing is closer to Hinduism than Buddhism. You see, we worship at the same shrine, whether it be Kataragama, Adam's Peak, all three communal religious groups go up there, you see.
Of course, when I used the term fascism, I didn't necessarily mean extermination. But what I meant was a kind of single Buddhist dictatorship, in the sense that certain political liberties, in the name of the general good, would be suppressed. Maybe even the parliamentary system, if they feel that it is necessary.
If I do not subscribe to this view as yet, but if economic progress can be accelerated in the absence of a parliamentary system, without doing damage to the general concept of liberty, I do not see why we should necessarily underline the continuation of a parliamentary system.
No.
You see, it may not be suited to the genius of our people.
Frankly, I'm not particularly enamored of a parliamentary system.
On the other hand, we might safeguard those very liberties by a highly developed form of local government and highly centralized authority in the field of economic investment. That means that, as in all communities, the problem will be What is democracy? Is it political or economic? So you take the island as a whole, and because of the father state of the economy, you have almost a military approach to the economic redevelopment of this country and its investment policy. And yet guarantee to the vast mass of our people, of all races, certain fundamental liberties which don't encroach on other sects because of their racial or religious beliefs, racial origins or their religious beliefs. But at the same time, you can have a certain form of dictatorship in investment policy, in compelling harder work.
No, frankly, I'm not so much in favor of the parliamentary system. What I would not like is an attempt which would almost inevitably follow to control the thinking of the people, educationally and otherwise, and to channel it into very narrow levels, which I will feel in the long run will have a bad effect on the whole country. Say you have this sort of state is set up, and you have a chap like Iriagola handling this education machinery and the propaganda services, which will be increasing as time goes. There won't be any real freedom and any freedom to criticize, and in fact even self-criticism will suffer.
Why did you then ask me the question that you worried about, based on the fact that you worried about an SLFP fascist dictatorship? For Iriagola is a member of the UNP, isn't it?
Yes,
you see what I mean? Are you suggesting that danger can arise even through the SLFP?
It is. You see, the difference between the SLFP and the UNP, UNP also can set up a dictatorship, but it won't be as popular dictatorship as the SLFP.
No dictatorship is popular in the long run.
No, but what I mean is that its base will be far too capitalistic.
No, but the UNP dictatorship will well be a racial and religious minority dictatorship. It will be a Catholic dictatorship and even maybe a Tamil Catholic dictatorship. By that I don't mean that the leadership will be Tamils and Catholics, but drawing support from those two groups, its most powerful allies, and then America will come in, and in exchange ask for things. As a matter of fact, I don't know that these run of election victories is not forcing the UNP to think on those lines, because I believe that they must know that in a general election they will be wiped out, and that for that very reason, whether they are not already, now the army is being decentralized. The ammunition dump is being decentralized, what was originally at 140 is being decentralized throughout the country. And the UNP is also feeling the effects of bringing these 27 fellows or 28 fellows to trial. They have given the army a cause now, which is Buddhism. They have given the army symbols like Udugama, Sigera, Jnanasiya, priest, Sunil Hevadi. Now for the first time, the symbols of the armed forces, that is the army, the navy, the air force and the police, 25,000 of them altogether, their perspectives are intertwined with the perspectives of Bandar Nayaka and 56. Now, this creates a completely new situation in the country, I think, especially when these fellows are released.
Frankly, there is that possibility, but say the coup attempt in 61, if that had succeeded, it would have been a dictatorship of a few. Whereas, if the SLFP come to power through an election and then don't have any more elections and set up a dictatorship by using various propaganda machinery, then it will be a fairly broad-based dictatorship, at least for a while. And
it will be therefore the dictatorship of the majority then.
Of the majority. But then is
that not democracy?
Yes, but that's different. If they prevent criticism, because under the democratic system there are means of criticism.
So then would your fears be met if the press bill was withdrawn? Or rather, if the SLFP in power would not introduce a press bill. Now I believe, this is a personal belief of mine, that considering the manner in which the left newspapers are developing, you know, Atta has a circulation of Veldai 50, I think, not 50,000. I believe Janadin had about 15. Sinhale, which is a weekly paper, has about 15 to 20. I believe they are making Sinhale a daily paper. So the combined press of the Sinhalese, through the Sinhalese language, would touch a lakh to lakh and a half or even 2 lakhs once restrictions on newsprint importation are released. In addition, they are developing the English newspaper Nation. With those weapons in the hands of the left movement, when it forms a government, it will not be necessary to gag anybody. Because that those and the radio also will come over to our side at that time. For that reason, it will not be necessary to get the real news. Can well be allowed to abuse us, because we can then call them to order by a article contradicting them on the following day. Just as much as if you do not agree with certain news items which are the publishers, the Daily News goes in for it now in a big way, and vice versa. So I think you need not worry about the press bill. I do not think it will be a real.
No, I was not thinking of the press so much as the fact that the state has a very, very powerful weapon
in education.
Education, which it can direct and which it can use to propagate. And also, say, if you take the newspaper, it's that much easier.
One premise from which you're arguing, I'm not being rude, but I'd like you to look at it when I put it this way, you might appreciate it. You are bringing into a colonial environment the prejudices you have acquired of a liberal education at Oxford, where an alternative policy.